always wanted to know who the best player was on tour simply because I wanted to actually work as hard. And then I ran into a little guy by the name of George Knutson out of Canada. And I watched him hit the golf ball. I watched him with the wide stance, making the club back way inside, releasing the club. One of the greatest ball strikers I'd ever seen.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the McKellar Golf Podcast. My name is Lawrence Donegan, and before I introduce my co-host, I have to do the usual. I think we'll start this week with McKellar Magazine. If you haven't subscribed already or haven't got your copy of our issue number 7, please go to mckellarmagazine.com. You will find a wonderful, wonderful, I like to call it a literary journal. Our co-founder Tom Dunhays, when I say we are, McKellar is the New Yorker of golf. So this week I'll say McKellar is the Atlantic Magazine of golf, full of great writing, great stories, mckellarmagazine.com. The other quick...
Fits in a stocking, by the way. You left out, I mean, we're getting to Christmas season now, Lawrence. It's a stocking stuffer.
There we go. That was my co-host, Jeff Shackelford. Jeff, no, it's okay. Before you interrupt, I just want to direct people to your newsletter, The Quadrilateral. It's at Substack, an absolutely essential element of my week as a golf nerd, golf nut, follower of golf news, the Quadrilateral. Go to substack.com and subscribe. Join the many thousands of subscribers, Jeff?
Yes, that is correct. Join the family. It's been a little quiet because it's not the major season, but this is going to be in the notes package of the week, and I'm just bracing for all the distance news in December. So I'm just kind of regrouping and preparing some things and trying to lay low a little bit too. That's the point of the of a seasonal newsletter, although it really is year round now. golf news is coming fast and furious.
If only the PGA Tour would take a bit of a break. I think that's been one of our things for a long time. But no, continues. The fall season continues. I've no idea, Jeff. There is some kind of points thing going on here, and people are playing for cards, but it's completely lost on me, which is says a lot. I guess we should start with very, very quickly with it. I've written it down here. The Worldwide Technology Championship, Los Cabos in Mexico on Sunday. A couple of interesting things. Firstly, it was a brilliant finish won by Erik van Rooyen. Really eagled the final hole to beat Kuchar and Camilo Bajegas by two. I didn't watch much of it, Jeff. Did you see much of it? I mean, again, lots of great storylines kicking around. But my main interest was the golf course designed by Tiger Woods, Tiger's first PGA Tour event held on one of Tiger's golf courses, El Cardenal at Diamante, I think it's called. What did you think of the golf tour? And what did you think, more importantly, what did you think of Tiger's golf course?
Well, I enjoyed it. I didn't tune in until Sunday, and I thought it was a fantastic finish, as you saw, and just, you know, what you hope for in a golf tournament. Different characters, different ages, different stories, and a couple of guys who've one guy in particular who's been through a lot. Another one who's experiencing a lot of grief right now with a friend with terminal cancer, and he wins the tournament with an eagle on the last hole, and a lot of people made some nice putts, and I thought it was, I mean, the coverage was pathetic as always now with the budget cuts. I mean, just they're nothing against people doing it. They're working with literally the bare minimum. Just didn't get a good sense of the golf course. What are you going to do? They just didn't have much in the way of gizmos and fun stuff and good aerials and flyovers of holes what we really needed were some graphics kind of illustrating the green contours. Tiger put some serious stuff into those greens. I saw a few guys that don't think they really cared for them, but I enjoyed it. I love, you know, just seeing golf in Cabo's great. There's a real golf atmosphere down there, and it just didn't look like a venue suited to tournament golf because it kind of had native areas immediately to the sides of the course and not great for spectators, but it looked like they made it work.
Yeah, the my my again, I didn't see much of it, but the thing that piqued my interest, always piqued a lot of people's interest, actually, those who care.
Let's be careful on that. A lot of interest. I looked at the ratings today, and nobody watched it Saturday and Sunday. It averaged about 150,000. So it was like a live, like a really good live event.
Well, the interesting stat that everybody jumped on was Adam Long hit 56 out of 56 fairways.
Right.
As a golf, well, you're a golf course architecture guy. It strikes me that that's a bad thing. That suggests that this is not a test of every club in the bag, not by any stretch of the imagination. Have I got that wrong, or is that a good thing? I don't know.
It didn't bother me because he finished tied for 23rd and he hit 56 greens. So it means he missed 16 greens from the fairway. And I don't really think that good golf is necessarily about just who hits it in a strip of fairway. I think it's a lot more fun when it's old school Augusta and it's wide and certain sides of the fairway matter more. I just couldn't get a sense of whether the angles mattered. A few times the announcers noted somebody did have a better angle at certain pins. So that width is, you know, meaningful in those cases. And that's what you really hope for. I guess I also find some of the criticism of it strange, just because we know how forgiving the driver is now. And you combine it with how far they hit it. And I just don't really feel like that stat is something to be alarmed about in the grand scheme of things. And, you know, he hits it a long way, too, by the way. This wasn't like an old school Calvin Pete plotting every fairway. Adam Long gets it out there pretty far. And he still he still didn't sniff a chance at winning. So I don't know if it's the end of the world. And I mean, everybody hit a lot of fairways. Van Rooyen missed, three or four, I think. So not a big deal.
I date a golfer, this brilliant stat about the amateur from Arizona State, Preston Summerhayes.
Uh-huh.
On the first day, he hit 14 out of 14 fairways, 17 out of 18 greens, and only beat six guys in his half of the draw.
Wow.
By the way, I think he's played, that's his second PGA Tour event this year. I think he played at Fortinet, and he was the longest guy in the field at Fortinet. So he's no Calvin Pete either, I have to say. Here are the other, I think Tiger was there earlier in the week, but the big, my goodness, the other Tiger news, that Tiger was seen caddying for his kid, Charlie, at the National, the Notre Begay, the third, whatever the tour's called. I just know that the entry fees are just ridiculous.
They cover those for a lot of the kids that are in the tournament. Yeah. It's a very cool setup the way Notre's done it. Yeah, it's not an AJGA Brat Fest at all. This is actually designed for kids who don't have the means. So just to be clear, that's Noto would not be happy if we made this. Yeah, he and Ryan Burr worked very hard to make sure that was the case. That a little like what's Steph Curry's underrated setup is doing too with his
I'm glad you said that, Jeff, because my only experience with the Notre Begay Tour was there's a qualifier down the street, I'll send a spoiled brat down there,
yeah,
and getting into the entry process and coming to the pay here and thinking, oh my goodness, anyway, but I guess that's we could afford it. Anyway, we didn't play. Sorry about that, Nota. It struck me as a bit odd because Notre Begay is, that's not at all what he kind of stands for, or no, where he's coming from, or anyway. But the point being, two points actually. The point that everybody's making is that Tiger carried 54 holes, 3 days. Therefore, he's back. He's back again. He's going to be winning major. I don't know, Jeff. You saw the video. It looked to me like he was walking with a pronounced limp.
By the end, yeah. But early on, he looked good. He was walking. The gait was incredible out of the chute. And there was actually a PGAtour.com article with a big headline: Tiger Woods caddies 54 holes for son Charlie at National Junior Golf Event. Right up there with his cut streak and his 15 majors, he caddies 54 holes.
Yeah,
I get it. They're excited.
I do see that there's a spot left open at his hero challenge. I think. Yeah. So
it's not for Patrick Reed. That I know.
All right. There you go.
No.
The one thing that I looked it up after I saw Charlie finished tied 17th in the 14 to 15 age group. I wrote it down somewhere. I think he shot a nice 68 in the final eight.
My point just being, final round,
yeah, pretty good. Tied 17th. I think he finished 13 shots behind the winner. I feel heartened when I see this stuff because people go crazy. I think I've spoken about this before. People go crazy about Charlie Woods. His swing does look great. I have to say that. Whenever I see video, his swing's getting better.
It's just
and better
amazing. There. It's a Rory simulation. It's incredible.
It's really good. But it just tells me that, you know, he's taking care of business at school. Golf isn't his entire life. Clearly, mum has put the kibosh on this. He's taking care of business at school, I would imagine. It's not all of golf 24/7, and that's a really, really good thing, particularly given the madness that surrounds Charlie Woods. He looks to me like a kid who is heading smoothly. He'll be taking care of the academics because mum is certainly very smart, and Tiger's pretty smart as well. Great golfer, it sounds to me. I think his college berth. You think he could get a sniff at getting into Stanford as a golfer?
I bet he knows a few people. Yeah. Well, of course, we've got somebody nominating him to be Tiger's caddy when he returns, which I thought was one of the more embarrassing takes I've seen in a while. But I think Tiger will find a professional looper.
You did mention
that was on PGA Tour Sirius XM Radio where that crack take came from.
No surprise there. You did mention the ratings of the, I mean, that like a live event, really, that low. What does that mean?
You have a lot of people have cut the cord, so Golf Channel reaches fewer homes. Probably the old fall events used to do 250,000. They never have done well. So they're down to 150,000. The more amazing thing is how Saturday, it just doesn't even get a rating anymore. College football, everybody talks about the NFL. College football is the thing that's just obliterating the PGA Tour. And Bob Herrig wrote a piece on SI.com. They're doing like bad takes week or something. And so he said, you know, the tour, they're just trying to come up with what's the worst idea that's not that horrible, actually. And he suggested they should play 54 holes and end on Fridays. And frankly, I mean, those numbers are so low, you might as well try something. I this time of year, I'd love to see him play a 14 or 12 hole tournament, something. But yeah, there's not a lot of interest. They've been in our face too long, Lawrence. It's people are interested in other stuff this time of year. And they just, this is my big concern. I may write it in this newsletter tonight, but it's my concern with this TGL thing. Right now these guys have been in our face talking money and all their grievances about their value. And I just think people are a little bit tired of them, and they really need to all kind of go away and pop up, you know, at the father, son, or the hero. That's about it. And resurface in January. And but that's just kind of where we're at now with the live world and everything else. Golf's just, these people are in your face nonstop, and it's oversaturated, and they don't have a mechanism to deal with it.
We'll come on to the launch of the TGL in a bit. And I think that plays into this this idea that nobody ever goes away anymore. I mean, if you don't go away, how can you come back? You know, that's it just seems to be like a 52 week a year grind for everybody. That includes the audience. But here we are, Jeff. We still have these guys around all the time. We should, at this point, if we were Scott and Carol on Pivot, we would play big story of the week. We'll move on. I'm not sure that was a very good link by me, but the big story, I guess, well, certainly for me, our good friend Eamon Lynch at Golf Week dropped it on Saturday. It's weird. Imagine dropping a story like that on a Saturday. What's going on there, Jeff? Is that just a Golf Week scheduling thing, or...?
I think he writes a Sunday column, so they drop it on, as soon as it's ready to go, they drop it. But yeah, it's not exactly the time you would generate the most news, but yeah.
Again, a small point, but it's dropped on Saturday and there was very, very little traction. I mean, you can see the number of views on Twitter or whatever and social media. Tiny number of people retweeting this or reposting it or liking it. So I guess it wasn't noticed very much. Anyway, the headline was pretty PGA Tour narrows list of potential investors to five, including, I thought this was quite interesting, including a powerful group called Friends of Golf, named as Friends of Golf. And then the first couple of lines, PGA Tour has winnowed the list of companies being considered as private equity partners in its new for-profit entity, and it includes the most prominent figures in American finance. Golf Week has learned from more than a dozen initial suitors, five groups remain in the mix to be the primary investment partner in PGA Tour Enterprises. First things first, Jeff, I remember the good old days when there was no bidding process. It was just the PIF and the PGA Tour had reached some kind of framework agreement. Lo and behold, without any kind of announcement or any kind of indication from the parties involved, the PGA Tour appears to be moving on. I think, you know, this might come as a surprise to most people, except the people who listen to this podcast. We've been talking about it for weeks and weeks. Isn't that amazing? I mean, we've seen already, again, Eamon talks about this later on, there's a source he quotes that's saying that progress in the PIF and PGA Tour talks appear to be less than zero. So it appears we are already in the post-framework agreement era, correct?
Yes. We've been in it a while. They're all just trying to make it look like we're not. But the signs have been there for a while, Lawrence. It's clear they want to move on with something else, but they have to pretend that that something still could happen and it would be the best thing and blah, blah, blah. Oh, please. They're just trying to avoid another lawsuit.
Why are they pretending? I don't understand
for that reason.
That. Why
well, they made an agreement, and I think they want to show that they made their best effort to make it work. And then when it doesn't, they can say, "Well, we tried our best; that it just didn't happen." Is that?
Yeah,
I don't think that's illogical. Do you?
Well, I kind of do because you know, and certainly not in the Saudis' interest to maintain that pretense. Surely, I mean, why would they put up with this? They're basically being embarrassed and humiliated by the PGA Tour. So I don't understand why would they put up with it? I don't get that. That's my
Well, what are they supposed to do at this point? They're not supposed to. They're still negotiating. So until it completely falls through, why would they do anything to upset or to create more tension in the negotiation if they're still in fact negotiating? So they're behaving properly. It's the other side that can't seem to keep a lid on the fact that they're getting these unsolicited bids. I can't say that without laughing. And the other side is trying to it seems like let people know that this is going on, but then also it's not, and it's their way of doing business. We'll see how it goes over with the people involved. I think you would agree a lot of those people who were named in Eamon's story are not the kind of people who like to see their name in print before a deal is done. And there's always that chance they may get annoyed by the fact that it looks like this information's being put out there. Well, first, too many people know about it, so that somebody like Eamon can put all that together and write a story, that's going to make him mad. And then if any part of that was shared to go public, that's not going to make him real happy because it seems like it's a leverage play. So we'll see how it goes over. There were a couple of names in those entities that are some pretty ruthless, cutthroat private equity types.
Yeah, I should probably. I don't understand the PR strategy either. I have no idea why you would. I'm assuming that this Eamon is a great journalist. I'm assuming that his story is it comes from many sources and is pieced together. But I'm also very certain that if Jim Owen had clicked on that link on Saturday night, he wouldn't have gone, "Oh my goodness, I didn't expect this." So if that's the case, and I assume that it is, I just do not understand the strategy of throwing all this out there in public. I'm not smart enough to understand it. Anyway, Eamon names the five groups. Let's go through them one by one. Sorry, go on.
Before you do that, I think you also have to just keep in mind. So you have the chance right now. A few players could jump to live, and that seems to be the thing they're most fearful of. And when this deal happens, they're going to find a way to funnel money to some players who passed up live advances, and you want it out there that you've got robust offers coming your way to let somebody maybe with the initials JR or I don't know, just take a pick.
Yep.
I just picked that out of a hat that, you know, this money is coming. Hold your horses. Don't do anything rash, whatever. There are any number of reasons they could want it out there. Some of them are very legitimate, I think, and some are could backfire. We'll find out. But I do think that you have to keep that in mind, that they're still very nervous about that prospect of defections.
The Rory addressed that this week, didn't he? I will come on to his the TGL and the launch of his team, the Boston Common. But he mentioned that he'd spoken to John Rahm last week, and everything seemed to be fine. I'm not sure. Rory would be the first guy that John Rahm would be telling his plans. He said he spoke to him on the phone.
He feels he's not going to make the move. And I think ultimately he is out of the TGL because of the travel situation. And it's a fantastic little piece of a fantastic little leverage play to go, you know, I'm not totally in your little boys club yet. So let's see what the check is. Let's see what can't hurt him. But mostly, yeah, he didn't want to be flying back and forth to Florida for the $21 million purse over 15 weeks or whatever it's been reduced to now. They've cut the schedule down.
Anyway, the five groups, let's go through them, Jeff. We might know a little bit more than people listening to this.
I know nothing about these people. Come on.
The one thing you would say, they are all five are very, very serious people. And we're just two jabronis with a Zoom account. And so what do we know? However, let's name them. Then we'll come to, you've got a really interesting take on this. But the first group is Fenway Sports Group. The owners of the Boston Red Sox, Liverpool FC, and other assorted teams around the world in various sports, I think. They're combined. They're together with Steve Cohen and Arthur Blank, I think it is. Again, both very serious people. Steve Cohen is the owner of the New York Mets, isn't he?
Yes.
How's that gone over the years? Has that been a disaster?
It's not off to a great start, but he's tried to spend a lot of money on the team this year and it just didn't go well. And so I don't want to criticize him because he was trying to win. So as a sports fan, it's hard to ever not, you just can't criticize an owner when they're trying to win and it's their money. So the problem is I think they're in for a couple of rough years.
And Arthur Blank, I think he's the owner of the Atlanta Braves. He's a big time Democrat.
Falcons.
Oh, is it the Falcons? He's a big time Democrat contributor, I think, a big supporter of Obama.
Oh boy, that's going to hurt his cause in the halls of Pontevedra.
Right. The second group was Liberty, again, fronted by Steve Mnuchin, who those of us who pay attention to politics will know was the Treasury Secretary, Donald Trump's Treasury Secretary for a little while. He was also the guy who took his wife to Fort Knox to celebrate some eclipse or something and sort of tried to write it off as a taxpayer-funded gig, but shifty. He... Kushner, he jumped into private equity after his spell after the Trump presidency. Lo and behold, Jeff, he picked up a bunch of money from Qatar and the Saudis. Very nice.
That's what he spent his final weeks in the. He disappeared after the Capitol riots, and yeah, he was over in the Middle East. Digging up some financing for his next venture. So it'll be interesting to see how that impacts his unsolicited bid.
Yeah, there you go. The third one is a really, it's kind of weird. Some outfit called Acorn Growth Company, yeah. I think it's called. Mm-hmm. I went to their website. All their investments are in, you know, military items, yes. Military companies. It's very, very odd. I even went to the length of looking up the list of partners. CEO Rick Nagel and Brandon Bradford, and shout out to Annie Walker, the CFO. I went through their bios. None of them appear to have any interest in golf or been involved in golf in any kind of way. Why would a company like that be interested in the PGA Tour? Weird.
It definitely was the one that stood out as the most unusual, because you just didn't see that obvious link to golf. So yeah. we'll find out.
Well, number four, Eldridge Industries, Todd Bueller. I've seen him described.
Bowley,
is it? Okay. I keep thinking of Ferris Bueller. there you go. Todd Bowley, who bought Chelsea. I mean, and something I do know a little bit about. He bought Chelsea, English Premier League team last year. Generally seen as an absolute disaster, although it's early days. I mean, did the same. He bought the Dodgers, and I think the Dodgers took a while to kind of.
He's part of the group. He's not the lead partner with the Dodgers, but he's very, very involved. For sure.
Well, and same story at Chelsea, and generally, I think they had four managers in 12 months, Jeff. I know you don't know much about football, but that's a lot.
That's a lot. Yeah.
And amazingly, hopefully the PGA Tour doesn't look. Nobody at the PGA Tour tells them this that. Before Todd showed up, Chelsea had just won the Champions League. Todd shows up and four managers, and they finished 12th in the English Premier League. So they go from winning the Champions League in the April to not qualifying for any European football 12 months later. Not the kind of transformation I think the PGA Tour is looking for, but you never know. Group five, I guess this is probably, we'll come on to them a little bit. It's the most interesting group. They go under the name and story. The Friends of Golf, he mentions a couple of names, Henry Kravitz and George Roberts, who are famously part of the KKR private equity group, who I think, Jeff, if I remember my Barbarians at the Gate, I think they kind of essentially invented or certainly had a big part in shaping that world of leveraged buyouts. Again, I don't know what they're up to, but they're involved. What's missing, Jeff, is, again, we spoke about it last week, you know, the Ari Emanuel, the Silver Lake, the Endeavor crowd, who were kicked out of the initial bidding phase. I think the idea that they've gone away is simply absurd, but it's also odd that they're not mentioned amongst these five groups, which makes me wonder if they might be working outside the existing ecosystem, which includes LIV and PGA Tour. I think we spoke about it a couple of weeks ago or maybe last week. The prospects of a third tour loom large, I think. Can I ask you, Jeff? I can't get it. I don't understand it. Why are these people interested in the PGA Tour? I don't see where the return is.
No, that's the struggle, and I will defend Bowley, because other than the Chelsea situation, the Dodgers situation's gone very well. He's been involved in a lot of really good deals. He owns a big chunk of the Lakers, which they bought from Philip Anschutz. So I wouldn't count him out as just because that situation in football hasn't gone as well. He's not stupid. Let's put it that way. He's a very successful guy. But that is the question I would have for all these people. I just would love to know what you're buying. I can only speculate. My sense is there's some real estate. I sense you're buying a media company. You know, the valuation of the European Tour productions based on the tour investment during the pandemic was very high. I don't remember the number, but it shocked me what it valued that at. So the tour's built out a media operation that runs the camera work and does everything on the broadcast now, and has ShotLink, and they view gambling as something that's coming. So all those are under the for-profit element, and perhaps they've detected a way that all of that amounts to a value and a return that makes sense. I don't understand it. You know, with the dollar figures we've been hearing, you know, $4 or $5 billion investments and things. My only hunch is that some of that is going to pay off some debts or to keep some players around, and then some of it's to invest in property would be my hunch. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw some really important properties in the world of golf be purchased by with this money, and the Tour's Enterprises unit manages those things, because that was something I think the public investment fund was interested in. And still is probably
the I can't remember the FSG the head of FSG who was speaking at the Boston Common launch the other day, or certainly adjacent to that. I think he did say there was he described the bid that they have made as, well, he didn't use the word substantial, but it did bumper or something huge. And of course, our old friend Alan Shipnuck, he spoke about on Twitter certainly this week that FSG's bid was enormous. There was a number kicking around. $10 million was kicking around. $10 billion was kicking around.
Wow.
Yeah, billion. That's billion with a B. Again, an extraordinary sum of money. And again, well, I certainly can't work it out. What you're describing doesn't add up in my mind to $10 billion for sure. But I'm guessing there might be something in ripping up all the TV rights deals and starting again, something
well,
like that.
Well, so that's the part I don't understand. The networks aren't going to like that just because you got into this bad situation and then you want to rip up our deal and you want us to pay you more. Like, have you guys not been reading the room on the news? Rights fees are not, look at the NBA, which is in pretty good shape in a lot of ways, and they can't quite close the deal on their rights deal. And that's just the world we're in. I mean, look at Sunday Ticket is been failing. Streaming is still, and I don't mean failing as a business. It had some technical issues, but streaming as a business is still a mess. And look at the actor strike and some of the wacky stuff going on there with trying to anticipate where it's going, and rights and AI, and it's a tough time to go back to those networks and say we want to rework the deal. Confuses
what
me
if
well.
Fox was desperate to get out of its USGA deal, and if the Tour went to NBC and said, listen, you want out, you know, we'll let you out, let's because it's not clearly not working for NBC, the golf coverage. And again, CBS invested lots of money. It's a great product. But again, they're not pulling the audiences that perhaps they thought they might be. Maybe there might be an option for them. If they were offered the chance to get out, they might say, thanks very much, let's go.
Well, they better have a backup option if that's the case. I don't think that's a possibility at the moment. I think NBC's making money. I mean, remember the way the Tour deal is structured. It's a brilliant structure for the broadcasters because the Tour sells most of the ads. So with the sponsorship, they lock in whatever the number, the percentage I've heard, 70 to 80% is just guaranteed advertising. So it's a pretty good deal. And I don't see them wanting to drop that one on their list of on the radar of issues for facing Comcast and Viacom. These are not this contract's, you know, just fine for them. The Golf Channel's another story, though. Maybe they do try to purchase with some of this money. They just purchase a channel and get it off Comcast's hands because they don't seem to care about it anymore. It's just a weird time to do it when it's you're in this transition. Why do you want to spend a lot of money on a channel? Unless it allows you to you have a vision to take it to streaming in a more aggressive way, and ESPN is interested in picking up more as it goes to its own entity. I mean, there are a lot of things, there are a lot of moving pieces that you could see scenarios where some of this could really work and make sense, and there are others where you just go, what are you paying for? I don't understand with this audience. So it's,
well, I mean, if I'm say I'm somebody at Acorn Companies, I would look at the Masters streaming package, the Masters digital package, and just say, hey, the Masters, Augusta National might give that away for free, but hey, I'm going to copy that package down to the last dotted I and crossed T and sell it to the general public. I mean, it's what the Masters digital package is wildly popular.
People yeah, but it's the Masters. It's Amen Corner. It's once a year. By the way, they go away. They pop up with their amateur tournaments, and otherwise they disappear after a tradition unlike any other. They let everybody else do their thing and they disappear, and then we're excited to see them again. So the tour is, it's oversaturated its product. It's overinflated the value of its stars and their star power. And now they're going to saturate it with more with the TGL. And the product itself, the way the game is played, is not as interesting as it should be. And I think they need to do a lot of work on that front. And I mean, look at baseball. Look what went on there this year and the way they finally addressed slow play and some other stuff, and the over emphasis on analytics and launch angle power game. And it really made a difference. Yeah, the World Series ratings were lousy, but there were other factors involved in that. And by the way, the last game wasn't so bad. And so the game was better, and you feel like baseball here has a momentum again. And I don't see that with golf. And by the way, I mean, look at the recreational game thriving probably is not helping the PGA Tour either. People are out playing golf on the weekends instead of watching golf certain times a year anyway. There's a lot there. I don't quite, I think nobody understands. Well, I think we're going to know soon though, Lawrence. We're recording this on the 8th. They have a meeting on the 12th. That article that Eamon wrote sure sounded to me like everybody kind of knows who's bid what, or somebody does, and the bidding process is over. Or maybe there was a deadline of, I don't know, today or tomorrow, if you want to give in one last number or something and bump it up a little, but sure seems to me like we're going to know soon.
My main interest in it, Jeff, really is what happens after the announcement is made.
The business side of this, who cares? I don't really. The business world, it'll be an interesting story for them. But to us, it's like, what are these people bringing to improve the sport?
Well, more than that, how does LIV respond, and how do the spurned bidders respond? Keep an eye on this Friends of Golf group. These are very serious people in that world. I think they might, you know, if they are not welcomed into the fold, I'm not sure that ends their interest in reshaping the landscape of professional golf. We spoke about it again. I'll mention it again. You know, maybe there is certainly a place in my mind for a third entity, which brings the two factions together.
Yeah.
Can you imagine five, six, seven, eight invitationals run along the lines of the Masters?
When?
A year.
When? Well, there's so much already. When are they going to fit it in?
Well, they don't care. Again, let's just picture it. They don't really care about the PGA Tour schedule. They've been spurned by the PGA Tour. Okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to run these six events a year. We're going to invite the 50 best players in the world. We're going to mark it as the only place outside the majors where you can see the best 50 players in the world play. Oh, and by the way, here's your Gordon Sargent. Oh, you remember that kid you've heard about from wherever? He's playing this week. Preston Summerhay, so I think there is a potential for that again. And the PGA Tour, well, when they're picking somebody, better be careful about who they're excluding, because these people seem to be very interested in how golf progresses over the coming decades. And, they might take their chance. We'll see. I guess we should really move on, Jeff. Actually, a couple of things of note, I'll mention them. Costco's bringing out a new driver, $199 driver to go with a Kirtland ball and a Kirtland wedge set. Strikes me, Jeff, that they've obviously had success with the wedges and the ball. And they're going the same way with the driver. They might have looked at the market. I think people are pretty fed up with $800 drivers. and they look at the really is thriving. Just a quick example, our local Nine Hole Muni, the Winter League, I got an email yesterday. We're having a Winter League. There's 72 players playing golf in Northern California in January. I mean, to me, that's
quite a barometer you've chosen. Yeah, but yes.
Well, but, however, it strikes me that this is a tell that golf at the grassroots level is thriving, is very vibrant. You have Costco jumping in. These are not silly people. They obviously spotted a market for that. Again, there just seems a theme to me is, you know, you speak about terrible ratings for the PGA Tour, that golf at the grassroots level appears to be thriving, and golf at the elite top level is really, you know, people seem to be kind of fed up with it, or, you know, bored with it, or just hang on, wishing for a break, as you talk about. That's a dangerous world for the PGA Tour as well, isn't it?
Well, in their minds, they've grown the game. They actually believe that their young players and the power game and guys wearing hoodies and being cool and all that, like they actually they really believe that. I mean, we found that out a while ago. That was very clear that even though we know that golf became a sport people turned to during the pandemic or came back to before for the reasons that were related to that, it had nothing to do with golf being the first sport back or that Will Zalatoris has got a lot of energy and that made people want to go pick up the game. I mean, they really, they talked themselves into that. They were the ones that sparked this resurgence. And it was a combination of economic factors, safety, outdoors, appreciation for the things we've always known. And I would say, but again, I would give very little credit to the tour on this, the legitimization of different forms of golf, top golf, par three courses, executive courses, nine hole rounds. We broke down a bunch of barriers. I say I write about it, but we laugh about some of the ad campaigns and initiatives and can't even keep them straight. But all the organizations were very involved in those kinds of things. PGA of America, PGA Junior League. I mean, look how many more kids play the game. But again, concussions in football, there are other factors that have driven people to golf. I don't really care. They're all good and it's great. But the idea that the modern PGA Tour game and the power game and the way they play and playing for more money, like that was the thing that really sparks people's passion. No way. Give me a break. There's so many layers, but they're all great. And I think the coolest thing is that it's just sort of breaking down the notion of what it means to be a golfer. It's not having a handicap playing Saturday mornings at a country club, and that all still going and going well. And those people do their thing and good for them. But other things have made it more palatable. That said, we did a state of the game. There are still all sorts of issues with the perception of the sport and places under threat because it's still perceived as this wasteful, expansive, obnoxious, elitist sport. And so there's still a lot of work to do, and especially on the public golf side of things to legitimize the sport in the eyes of people who look at it as excessive.
I don't want to leave this section without mentioning as organizations growing the game of golf, genuinely growing the game of golf. I always want to mention Youth on Course.
Oh, yeah. Weren't there some great numbers you mentioned?
Yeah. I don't have them to hand, but just incredible organization set up in Northern California, by the NCGA, really, Northern California Golf Association. Gives kids pay $30 a year. Gives them access to, I think it's over 1,500 golf courses now across the states. You can play golf at Harding Park for $5. Isn't that just quite
amazing? That's amazing. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. And that's what the beauty of that program is. It's not about photo ops and clinics and foundations. And I mean, yes, rich people make donations and they get a write-off, good for them and all that. But But I'm saying not, it's not this performative thing, and we're going to go to certain neighborhoods and give children clinics and get their picture. And you know, it's disgusting, frankly, some of it. And that, you know, is the beauty of youth on course. And we know if you turn a kid loose playing around a golf, they're going to get all the life skills. They're going to get exercise. They're going to have a good time. They're going to meet other people. It'll just happen the way it's supposed to happen. And that's, it's just awesome.
Just a wonderful program. Again, I mentioned Hardy Park, but there's some really incredible golf courses across the country that are given access. If I was in charge or running or the president or the GM of a top 50 golf course in the United States, I would gladly give away two tee times a week to youth on course. It would be a really great way to show that you're involved and are interested in growing the game of golf. So there you go. If you're listening to that and you're the GM of Fisher's Island, why don't you do that? Or National Golf Links. What do you think the chances of that are, Jeff? Wouldn't that be wonderful, though?
Some of those places have donated tee times for the fundraising element of it. They've donated some amazing packages in the past. In fact, when you were talking about that, I was thinking, aren't they about due for their auction? Because it's usually one of the, if not, it may be the best of all the auctions with what's given up. But yeah, no, I don't think we're going to see the country club world go to the model or just do things like they do over in the UK, Lawrence. It's just not an American thing. I don't think that's going to change for a while. Sadly.
We'll finish off with a chat about another attempt to bridge a gap.
Quickly, we'll say in my newsletter this week, I have some stuff from Alison Corpuz, who won the US Women's Open, and she still lives here, and she has worked out some deal with the Rolling Hills, but she turns up at some of the other courses where USC played. And it was just one of those things that, and I just thought that was so cool, because that's the kind of thing that used to go on in golf, and then it kind of stopped, or it became, you know, some elite places charged colleges for memberships. You know, one very close to me here that hosts way too many tournaments in a short span in the next few years, including the Genesis Invitational and the Olympics. Anyway, I digress. But these clubs, it's just one of those things where they get to know these women playing college golf. And it's like, well, she's turned pro now, and, you know, let's let her, you know, let her keep coming out here. She's won the US Women's Open, and now it's a point of pride at a place like Rolling Hills that she's, and I don't know what the deal is they worked out with her, but they did. And she gets to go out to Brentwood and other courses that USC played. And those are the kind of clubs that we need to hear more of those stories about, because they're still private clubs. They're still expensive. There's probably elitist in some ways, but those are the ways they're kind of giving back, and that are just nice. You know, they're just great. And isn't that cool? That's she wasn't rich. She was just a good player, and they should be proud of the fact that they were part of kind of continuing her momentum, especially because she had some real ups and downs. Anyway, so stuff like that, and clubs that sell very inexpensive memberships to promising players, you know, $500, whatever, and $30 a month in dues, you know, that stuff used to go on. I wish we could highlight more of those kinds of stories, because I think it sets a really good example.
Yeah, absolutely right. It gives me a chance to mention the Merit Club. We are the proud recipients, or somebody in our house is a proud recipient of a junior merit membership there. I think, exclusive, wonderful golf course. And I think you got to join for $100 or something. I don't
amazing,
know.
Yeah. And more amazing. Places used to do that. And the thing that people never understand is that pays a dividend immediately, because we know a good young player out on the range, somebody who's an average golfer who's a member, they just enjoy watching them hit a ball, or they may get to know them a little bit, and they end up playing nine holes with them. And it was just a refreshing thing for that member. And it's just, I've seen that. And it's just, it's all hard to pin down and explain to people. But if you know the game, you get it. And some places just get it. Some places just have that director of golf or superintendent or manager who just gets it. And then some places just don't. So it'd be nice to put these things out there so more places give back in those little more creative ways.
You're dead right. Listen, moving on, finally, the launch this week, it's already been
this week, it's going to be every day for the next
The TGL, which is yet another attempt to bridge the divide between elite golf and the broader public.
Is that what they're doing? Well, that's not. This is a business venture.
Well, there you go. Well, yeah. Again. Yeah. Anyway, I think I don't know where to start, Jeff. People listening to this probably know a little bit about it. There's six teams. I'll quickly reel them off. Atlanta. Oh, some of them have got names. The Atlanta Drive, Jupiter Links Golf Club announced this morning. Guess who's playing for Jupiter Links FC GC?
Tiger Woods and that bastion, that hub of Links Golf, Jupiter, Florida.
The LA Golf Club. Actually, that was Morikawa's announced last week. I'm thinking, why isn't Colin Morikawa, declaring his great joy in joining LA Country Club?
LA Golf Club, come on.
I know, exactly.
Well, he's from here, and I don't know. Didn't he get weepy or something? There was a social media post. I couldn't pull it up. I just couldn't do it. I just could not bear to see him pretending to act like this was the greatest perk that he's ever enjoyed in the history of life.
I saw the story about God, LA Country Club. They don't like this kind of stuff being shouted from the rooftops. It's LA Golf Club. Golf Club. And the other two teams, New York and San Francisco, don't have a name yet. So that'll be we'll all be on tenterhooks waiting for the announcement of the names. The first really big launch, it's on ESPN, starts in January. My goodness, it's coming around pretty quickly. I'm not going to go through the format. It's kind of a hybrid of simulator golf, and then there's a kind of green complex, a built-up green complex. Two of the teams play each other. There's, again, go and look it up on the website. I'm not going to go through it all. There's kind of, a modified alternate shot thing, and then there's three, whatever. It lasts for 2 hours, 15-hole contests. It goes across, I don't know how many weeks it goes over, and accumulates in a grand final, best of three, I think, Jeff. Best of three, and the winners, the winning team splits $9 million. There you go. But the launch this week, Boston Common was the first team to be really launched, that really pushed the boat out. FSG took the team, that was Rory, Adam Scott, Tyrrell Hatton. And Keegan Bradley, of course. So they went to Fenway Park and did a launch. I don't know, Jeff, I sat and watched the press conference, 25 minutes. Tyrrell Hatton didn't have very much to say for himself. What did you think of the whole thing? What did you think of the launch?
I did not watch the press conference. I read the stories. The hoodies were flowing. We're going to have hats on backwards. It's going to be... players trying to be cool. I think there are a lot of positive elements to it that are interesting, but I think the odds are against them in terms of just jumping first into this and rolling it out without a spring training and working out some kinks and a little bit more of an organic, look at pickleball. It started with some, I don't know, hippies up in Vermont or somewhere playing in the backyard, and it evolved. And we do have simulator golf. We have combines and trackmen and things like that. And so there's going to be a natural interest in it. But yeah, I'm struggling to understand a lot of elements as well. So we'll just have to see. I will defend them on the people are ripping the city-based teams. And remember, the original concept when the tour agreed to be friendly to this was that they would do this in cities of a tour event. And it made a lot of sense. It would be an early week promotional thing, and it would just be a little bit different. And
the Hero Challenge thing in European Tour Weeks.
Correct.
They would have which was really quite cool.
Yeah. So this made
them they would take them to great, I remember at London
Bridge.
About
that. That's right.
London Bridge. Yeah. It was really, really quite good. It had its own innate worth, such that it was, but it also promoted the European Tour event in the kind of locale. Yeah.
So that will eventually be what they do if this survives year one. It's obvious that's why they're sticking with the city names, and so that will be a positive. But clearly, a certain person with the initials TW and another one with the initials RM, who are founders of this, did not want to be flying all over the place. And we know that's why John Rahm realized, what am I? I can't be playing the West Coast swing and then flying back there. And now they've added 2 days, some of the weeks, to basically get it to end earlier. So I get why they have these franchises based in cities. It's just kind of wild when, you know, you're talking Boston and they don't even have a tour event anymore. And Adam Scott is, maybe by the end of this, Adam Scott's accent will be, although he doesn't really have much of an Australian accent, but he'll be like David Graham. It'll be part Boston and part Australia. You know, David Graham had that Texas meets Australia thing, but, Keegan Bradley's into Boston and that's great, but yeah, it the hoodies, we're putting on jackets, we're hawking merch already. It's just the hard sell. I get why they're doing it. Mike McCarley, who's the main guy behind it, is a great marketer. All that makes sense. Yeah, really good chat with him, by the way, on the sports media podcast.
Sports Business Journal. I heard that.
Learn a lot of more.
Jeff. Well, I came into it quite cynical, but the actual product itself, it seems fairly plausible, I would imagine, if they can generate some kind of atmosphere indoors.
Yeah,
it might work.
Yeah, no, I would agree. He got me to be a little bit more open-minded about some things. I'm just kind of at this point right now where I wonder if the timing is just rough in terms of asking the public to invest in these guys with kind of what's gone on the last year. And then doing it all from the one spot. Again, I understand why they're doing it in Palm Beach. It's convenient for most of the players, but it takes away some of the sizzle, I think, of the idea of moving it around the country. But again, I'm sure that's their end goal. And but I'm curious too on the financials. You know, $9 million for the team win is just to these guys not a whole lot of money compared to what's being thrown around for signature events and all that. And so. I'd like to know what else is involved, but I don't think we'll find out.
There's also, by the way, a
long shot scenario that these franchises are the beginning of the PGA Tour mimicking some element of LIV. So there's always that possibility too. I don't think that's what was the concept going in, but it may be a natural evolution of the idea. So. We'll see. They're going to have a referee and shot clocks, and it's only going to be 2 hours. I think, you know, Mike made a compelling case on that. We know golf takes the PGA Tour round takes too long. It's tough for TV. So, yeah, there are parts to it but, you know, Mike also greenlit shot makers. One of maybe arguably the worst things ever put on television on Golf Channel.
The 10 people who watch Shotmakers can put us on mute for a minute. That was a Golf Channel production, wasn't it? But it was, my memory serves right, it was a distinctly unpalatable group of people involved.
It was sort of influencery people, yes. And it was in Las Vegas at a Topgolf, and they filmed it in the middle of the night because, of course, Topgolf didn't want to give up the stalls during the prime hours. So, so these people were all working like at 2 a.m. And
not forgetting the golf was terrible as well.
The golf was terrible. You had people paid in the crowd to yell like, come on, sharks. You know, I mean, it was just the whole thing. So you are correct. Different quality of golfers. But as we know, you know, and that was the one thing where I cringed a little. Mike mentioned the banter and the witty banner that we're going to be in for. Not many of these guys are Lee Trevinos. They're not a lot of natural comedians out there. And that I hope they don't try too hard. Or if they do heckling, that it's got a little bit of a fun edge, not scripted and that kind of thing. So we'll we'll just have to see. I'm pleased he did not mention the betting part of it in that interview. So I worried this was really a betting driven venture, and it certainly did not sound like that was his inspiration for this. And I know Tigers guy, Rob McNamara, he says very involved. And I noticed he kept mentioning ties to the real game, the traditions of the game. So I have a feeling with Tiger's involvement, that's brought, and Rory too, I would say, because we know how he thinks, there has probably been a little bit of a, well, let's make sure we don't do anything too tacky here kind of thing. So, yeah,
well,
anyway, like I said, I'm anxious to see, but I think they have a lot of things going against them in terms of the difficulty of starting a new game without working out the kinks a little. So, but maybe they've been doing that more than we realize.
You make a very good point about pickleball, and just that, I mean, that organic growth is always best, but I guess they feel they don't have the time. They've got to get this up and running. The other issue I think they might have is with authenticity. I mean, it was 25 minute press conference. It was kind of awful. You know, Rory trying to forge some kind of spurious link with Boston. You know, there's a lot of Irish people who live in Boston. You know, just, I guess, I mean, they should really just stop that. You know, I mean, they're not fooling anybody. And, it, you know, to the extent that it makes any effect, it just pisses people off. So don't do that. I mean, Keegan Bradley could get away with it. But as I say, I've gone from a position of pretty healthy cynicism. But I'm pretty keen to see it. Pretty keen to see what it looks like. I'm hopeful that it'll do something. It'll engage a wider non-golf audience. I'll be interested to see where ESPN put it, Jeff. That will be a big tell. I do note that NBC had first option on this and they passed.
They did.
Which wasn't a good sign. But anyway, yeah, ESPN.
I think that's a problem. It's much better being on ESPN than, you know, USA or Peacock, and it's definitely for the league. It's definitely a better, it gives them a better chance of succeeding for sure.
Anyway, okay, Jeff, I think that we've covered a lot of stuff here. My goodness.
By the way, you didn't bring up the fact that that Luke Donald has gotten the blessing of multiple former captains now. Nice work by Tom DeAngelo of the Palm Beach Post. Did you see that? Where he?
I did not. Yeah.
He worked the Champions Tour range down at the Timber Tech.
There you go.
Which actually sounds like a great name compared to this week on the PGA Tour. We've got the Butterfield Bermuda Championship and the one of the all-time worst names. I think it's the Annika. What is it? The Annika at Gainbridge, or the Annika by Gainbridge at the Pelican, or oh my gosh, it's just horrendous. anyway, yeah, he got Harrington, Clark, Longer, and Monty all gave ringing endorsements for him coming back. Although Padraig, of course, being Padraig, who's always fantastic, he did say, his actual quote is, "I'm surprised anybody wants it," in terms of the captaincy at Bethpage. How about that line?
Wow.
Yeah. And I don't think he's necessarily wrong. It could be a tough gig. And that's kind of his view. It's like, does Luke really want to go through that? And yeah, it's New York market. You're going to have to do a lot of stuff. You're going to have to put up a lot of stuff. So, he's received the blessing of the elders, so it's just a matter of whether he wants to do it again.
I would put hold on that until nothing's done until Thomas Bjorn decides on the European Tour, so we'll leave it. So Luke better not be counting his chickens. Anyway, Jeff, we will leave it at that. I will talk to you again next week, Jeff. All the best.
All right. Thanks, Lawrence.